the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
That was Sarita singing Sunny in that beautiful, beautiful voice. And that was also the great speaking voice of Frank Sinatra the night he took over The Tonight Show and had me on as a guest. By the way, you could see that stand-up if you go to John Barber's World, his introduction. And the stand-up, and this is John Barber flying high. I would like to say I'm flying high in Las Vegas, Nevada, which I usually am live, but I'm not. I'm flying high somewhere over the United States. And this is only the first time, maybe the second time, I have ever pre-recorded a show. And I have the two most perfect guests. Of course, my sidekick, always Joe Satilli, the author and creator of News Vandal, with a lot to talk about with Paris and Trump pulling out. A lot of people have said Trump's father should have pulled out. But in any event, Joe will be with us at the half hour. But the guest that I have on right now is making his third appearance here. And I'm so excited because it only happened accidentally. And you've heard me say many, many times that all the great things in my life happened to me by accident. And this was an accidental meeting when I was in Los Angeles for the film. I'm also flying high because of the reception of the film. Now, it wasn't a mass reception of the film. I mean, when I started making this movie, I was well aware, if I'm going to tell Jim Garrison's story, and Jim Garrison's on The Tonight Show, he looks into the camera and he says, an element of the Central Intelligence Agency of our government killed our president. There is no doubt about it, okay? And then, if we go on to prove that elements of the media, as he said, were involved in the assassination before it happened, and as you have seen and heard, for those of you who are aware of this case, they have all been protected by the major media. So when I realized that I was going to be making part two of the Garrison tapes, and I was going to be attacking our government, Well, it's not our government, it's somebody else's government, but it's the military-industrial complex's government, and that I was going to be attacking the media, which is owned by the military-industrial complex and the CIA, Project Mockingbird. I knew I was going to be making a movie that would be packing them out. But there is going to be a very, very large underground audience for this film. Now, first, I'm extremely honest. I'm extremely straightforward, even if it reflects badly on me. I have come to three conclusions about this movie and its future. And one is, there were people who came that I never expected, who are the most respected critics and researchers into this area, and they were Jim DiGiugno, who has a great site called Kennedy's and King. He came a second night and brought a woman who has her own show. Her name is Lisa Peace. And then William Madsen Law came to see the show, as did David Lifton, who wrote Best Evidence, and another wonderful investigative journalist, Wayne Madsen. All of them absolutely loved the film. And as knowledgeable as they were about the case, they all said they learned something new. And everybody will who goes to see the film. But my conclusion is this. Those people like Jim and the others who came to see the film, they will absolutely love it because it is the definitive telling of that story, the death of democracy on November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas, and the birth of fake news in the middle of the 1950s, when Jim Garrison pointed out that the CIA created a project called Mockingbird to take over our media, which would create a new foreign policy by affecting the judgments of Americans who read newspapers or magazines or listen to the radio or television, because they would take this over to create a foreign policy that would create continual fake wars, something that Gore Vidal even warned us about back in the 60s, long before Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. So those people will love it. For a lot of people who are on the fence about the film, if they have half a mind, and half of that half a mind is open, when they see the mountains of unrefuted facts in the film presented in great storytelling fashion, I might add, if they accept just a few of those and allow them to seep in, the film has been a success. But the vast, vast majority of Americans, you could not pay to watch this movie. And the reason is Jack Nicholson said in A Few Good Men, you can't stand the truth. Americans could no longer stand the truth. They thought they could, but they realized if they understood the truth and started to march, as they did in the 60s to stop the illegal Vietnam War, which they were successful in doing in spite of the government and the police batons, they marched and voted with their feet. They went to jail to stop the war. That's because middle-class whites were coming back in body bags, something that the military-industrial complex decided they had to get rid of was a draft. Just dumb down the people enough, ship the jobs out of the country, they have no place to go, but come and enlist in the army and become our hired killers again. Well, these people, the vast majority of Americans, saw and marched with their feet when they knew that George Bush and Powell and Condoleezza Rice and all of them, Rumsfeld, were lying about what weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Millions of them took to the streets, and it did no good. That fake war continued, and Bush is laughing about it in this film. And people are repulsed by it. And they should be, because the man should have been arrested along with Condoleezza Rice and Powell and the rest of them as war criminals, as outlined by the Nuremberg judgments. But we also accepted a fake Warren Report investigation into 9/11 and the collapse of Building 7 they absolutely avoided talking about. So people saw that, protested, and realized they could do nothing. The biggest crime in America in 100 years, which is the birth of 9/11, the birth of Vietnam, the birth of Iraq, was the murder of John Kennedy by the military-industrial complex to get into Vietnam. And to do that, as Jim Garrison says at the top of the film, all that's standing in the way is a 5'9" Irish-American with red hair and blue eyes. And for an agency like that, it's like flotting a fly. When people see that and realize they have been lied to for 53 years, they are going to know, because of the other disasters, they can no longer do anything about it. They don't want to know the truth. They can't stomach it. So don't tell it to me. And you know what? I don't blame them. The reason I told this story is because I couldn't live with it. I had all this information and I had to get it out. And I'm not a preacher looking for converts. I'm just a storyteller looking to tell an interesting story. I think I succeeded in that. And I'm going to go one step further before I introduce my guest, who was suggested by three of the people who came to see the film. And I was thrilled to talk with him, because I love the man I'm going to introduce. I'm overwhelmed and impressed by his two books, which I will tell you about when we get to the when they get to the books. But I'm going to say this. In 1978, when I was unemployed and I wasn't even a citizen, I predicted I was going to change the face of American television with what I called the entertainment of reality. By accident, a year and a half later, Real People was on the air, the number one show in the country, getting a 50 share, meaning one out of every two television sets watching television was watching that show. I lost that show because I was trying to tell Jim Garrison's story. That is in the movie, just a little bit, because it's not my story. Okay, so I'm going to say this. This movie will outlast, I must say, I have to thank Oliver Stone for making JFK, because without his brilliant direction and writing and crafting that magnificently made film, the most important movie in America, since an important movie in America is one that affects society, and he got the Assassinations Act passed in 93, and some of those documents proving Garrison is right, is in some of those documents are in the film. So I have to thank Oliver for that. This is, by far, the most important movie ever made in America, because it is the absolute story of America. How they murdered a president, how they disrupted illegally a legal investigation into the murder when they sabotaged Jim Garrison. Long after great books like James Douglas' book are long forgotten and used as bookends or door openers, and long after JFK has faded even from YouTube, this film will be around as a part of history. Now, I'm not going to be around, but I assure you, your grandchildren will love that movie and say to themselves, my God, how did Americans allow that to happen? Anyway, to my guest, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to go on so long, because right now, being on a plane, I'm flying back from New York, but I haven't gotten to New York yet, but I'm really thrilled and excited about getting there, because I hear a lot of people have already bought tickets to see the film, and I'll be doing Q&As Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'm talking like it's a future. It's a past. So I did them Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But in Los Angeles, three fellas I met separately all said they knew my guest. And I've had him on twice, and he's going to come on a third time. I keep his book. I have three or four books, and Joe Satilli's News Vandal always at my side when I'm at the computer. And the book, two great books. One is called Drugs as a Weapon Against Us, and the other is called The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. It is a thrill for me to welcome this man to the show, because he's involved with the documentary about Tupac, which will have a much, much larger audience than mine has, and I predict he'll have a massive audience. And there's another Hollywood production coming out called Tupac, which opens on the 16th of June, which also will have an audience equal to Oliver Stone's film. Anyway, John Potash, welcome to the show. I'm so sorry I took so long. I got carried away. Anyway, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, John. Yeah, I appreciate. Thanks for the praise of my books, Drugs as Weapons Against Us and the FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. I just want to clarify. So there is a what they call a biopic, but a major Hollywood film coming out on Tupac Shakur on June 16th. And I'm actually not involved in that film. They just happened to use, in the latest trailer for that film, they used several key points from my book. And I doubt they credited my book, but that's okay. I'm just glad that those points are getting out to a much wider audience, because that film is going, you know, I mean, people are predicting already that it's going to top the box office because it's got a huge release, you know, and it's just, it's really highly anticipated. So, and it's, yeah, so the film is called All Eyes on Me, which was his best-selling album, Tupac's best-selling album. It happened to be his probably most negative album, because it was the album that came out
What's the title?
Title's All Eyes on Me.
And that's the title of the film?
Yeah, that's the title of the film made by these producers that I know of, but I don't really know. And so I just know that some of their points that they made in the film, I had first come out with in my book. And I actually hadn't heard those points in any other documentaries or films before, or books that I've read. So I'm just glad that they used them, you know, even though they never talked to me directly about them.
Who are the producers? Who's releasing it? And who's playing Tupac? And it's a great title, by the way, All Eyes on Me.
Yeah, it's the title of one of Tupac's biggest selling albums. And so the guy that's playing Tupac is actually a unexperienced actor who just happened to look a lot like Tupac, and that's a shame. But the trailers look pretty good, and some people are already, you know, praising it very highly who've seen the movie already. Other people not so much, but the trailers show some very key important political points about Tupac that I've never seen said anywhere else. You know, that I put it in my book in my documentary.
Well, tell us about those. First of all, I want to say to you, you are a true, I hate to say this because it sounds so corny, but you are a true American. You're a true Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart American, because you know how many people would be crying for credit if they knew a producer and a writer had taken material obviously from your book without crediting you, let alone not paying you, they would be outraged. But the fact that you just say so benevolently, you know, I'm glad that it's out there. So tell me what those two or three points are.
Well, I've only seen that particular trailer once, actually, because I'm so busy with other projects and stuff. But one of the key points is that they said this, they've heard that there's over 4,000 pages in Tupac Shakur's FBI file. Now, I filed a Freedom of Information Act in 2000, and it took about a year or two before I got a response. But when I talked to the Department of Justice, they said, we're not allowed to tell you how many pages are in his FBI file. And so I kept talking to the woman, you know, at length about it all. And she ended up telling me, she ended up letting slip that, well, there's over 4,000 pages that, you know, they have to copy for you. And she let slip also that, you know, she may have told me on purpose, I don't know, but she said it takes 10, you know, it's 10 cents a page, so it's going to cost you over $400. And so, yeah, I put that in my book, I put that in my film, I put a copy of the letter from the Department of Justice saying, here's what you owe, it's about, I think it was $405 I had to pay to get them copied, all those pages copied. And so I put all the evidence in my film and my book. And the film just was a really low-key film. It came out a long time ago, like 2009. But and so I put a copy of it in my book, the copy of the page they sent me in my book and all that stuff to show the evidence of that. And the fact that they're saying this in a film that's going to reach, I really think it's going to reach over 100 million people. I mean, I think 100 million people are going to go see that film. It's really that, you know, popular right now. It's just talked about that much. But anyway, so I'm glad of that.
Let alone the black population. I mean, they will flock to see that film. I know.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, now you get these 4,000 pages. Two questions. Why would the FBI be so interested in Tupac? They'd have to go to the trouble to fill 4,000 pages.
Right.
Did you discover something really interesting in those pages? And why did they fear? They obviously feared Tupac, and why?
Right. And so they only sent me 99 of those pages, and even those pages were heavily redacted, you know, blacked out, you know. And so the reason they feared him so much is because of the fact that he was you know, born, you know, his mother called him the Black Prince of the Revolution because she raised him to be a revolutionary in terms of changing society for the better. And that's what she was about. She was head of the Harlem Black Panthers. His extended family were top Black Panther leaders throughout the country. He remained close with them his whole life. Tupac was head of the New African Panthers when he was 17 and 18 years old, and they were already active in about 8 to 10 cities in the country. And so he was already a national black leader before he became a rapper. And so once he became a rapper, he decided, I'm going to leave this leadership position in order to try to get, you know, ideas out in a different way. And so, but he still kept the activism going. And some of his activism, the most important activism, was that his Black Panther extended family was brokering peace truces between the Bloods and Crips, first in Los Angeles, then throughout California, and then throughout the country. And they were getting gangs to turn on to activism, to the point that they inspired the Young Lords, the, you know, Latino version of the Black Panthers, to get the Latin Kings to convert to activism. And so that stopped so many gangs from drug dealing and turned them into these radical activists. And that took literally billions of dollars out of the hands of the CIA, the top traffickers in the world, and the banks and multinational corporations that were laundering all that money. You know, and when you launch, so that's part of it, yeah.
That is so interesting. When you think of the murder of Martin Luther King, okay, so it obviously was not Ray, but it was set up as a white man. But in the setup for the murder of Tupac, the engineering of that had to be brilliant because they obviously said to themselves, well, we can't do it with another James Earl Ray. We got to get a black guy in there. Now, this must have been very, very difficult to film and write for the producers and writers of this film. I mean, it was a lot easier for Oliver Stone to craft his killers because there was so much evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald did not do it. So yeah. It must have been a struggle. Do you know anybody who has seen those scenes and how did they go about? Tell us how they went about murdering Tupac.
Well, I don't know about the film because I haven't seen it yet. I've only seen the trailer. I just got off the phone with someone today, though, that said that it's a part of Tupac's actually family. I'm not going to mention her name. I don't know if she wants to be talked about, but she wasn't as happy with this film. But you know, of course, everyone's got their own reasons. Everyone has their own wants certain aspects of Tupac to be highlighted that may not be highlighted. But the key thing about all this is that, you know, like a high-level white police detective named Russell Poole said that when he started investigating Biggie Smalls' murder, who was a rapper friend of Tupac's, who after Tupac died, he was the top rapper in the country, he found that his fellow police officers in Los Angeles set up in the murders of both Tupac and Biggie. And when he talked to the supervisors about that, they just shut his investigation down, he said. And this came out with in a film by Nick Broomfield. You know, you probably heard of him. He did some very good documentaries, one called Biggie and Tupac, another called Kurt and Courtney. In his film, this guy says, you know, I found that there was dozens and dozens of my fellow officers at all levels of death row records. And what I came to find was that Death Row Records was a U.S. intelligence front company. There's just no other. Yeah. So they got Tupac out of jail by him signing. He said if he agreed to sign to Death Row Records, he knew he'd be let out of jail. And they were basically, you know, torturing him in jail. And he just had to get himself out of there. And so he signed a 3-record contract, a 3-CD contract with Death Row. He gets out, he lets them produce his stuff, and it's the most negative stuff, sadly enough. All Eyes on Me happened to be a very negative album. But once he was done his 3-CD contract, he was, you know, he was leaving Death Row Records. And within, you know, a week of firing the real head of Death Row Records, he was killed.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
you mentioned quickly, you said something, your film. Are you doing a documentary about Tupac?
Well, I'm doing actually a documentary on my second book now. I did a very simple film, about a 80-minute, very simple film on the first book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. And that's been out since 2009, but that's very just it's images and narration. It's, you know, but my second film, after doing this for a while, I was able to get more sophisticated with it. And it's funny because I actually showed Jim Garrison on Johnny Carson just like you did in my film. But this is a film on drugs as weapons against us.
Oh, wow.
And, Yeah, and I show Garrison, I show the evidence. I show another guy, James Galbraith, I think his name is, professor whose father was a close associate of JFK, talking about how he was pulling out of Vietnam, and have a tape of JFK saying he was pulling, describing how they were pulling out of Vietnam, what the plan was about Vietnam and all. And so that's part of my Drugs as Weapons book, because of the fact that I show the evidence that JFK's pulling out of Vietnam was part of the reason he was assassinated, and because the top opium fields in the world, top poppy fields in the world to produce opium and heroin are in Vietnam, in the Golden Triangle area right next to Vietnam. And so that was a major issue that they had against JFK. Of course, another major issue is his anti-war stance in general. Another major issue is that he was closing down MKUltra, which was the CIA's program to use drugs as weapons against us. And so those are some of the reasons I have him in my film. And of course, I have RFK in my film too.
You're doing one on RFK?
Well, no. See, the film is about all the people in my book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. So it's mostly about John Lennon, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, and Tupac Shakur. But it also, also has a good bit about the Black Panthers, a good bit about the Students for Democratic Society, and it touches on, some of the other people on the cover of the book, such as JFK, RFK. It just touches on MLK and Malcolm X, because I'd already covered them in my first film so much. But then it does more on these other people that were like, the Rolling Stones and Janis Joplin and people like that too.
Well, that sounds fabulous. A couple of questions. First of all, a couple of other things about JFK. Mm-hmm. He was trying to get AIPAC to register as a foreign lobby, mm-hmm. and was about to take them to court because, of course, there was a court battle because AIPAC did not want to register as a foreign lobby. And then he was leaning on Israel to open up the doors at Dimona so the United States could investigate their nuclear facilities. And, of course, the Israelis shut the door and said, no way would we do that. As a matter of fact, they sent one of their scientists to jail for 10 years for admitting that we have an A-bomb. Are you funding this yourself?
I am, yeah.
Do you have a GoFundMe site?
I don't.
Well, let me tell you, when I started this, I had a GoFundMe site set up.
Uh-huh.
Within one day, I got $500 from one person.
That's great.
And I was stunned, okay? Then I forgot about it because we would get $15 or $20 or $25. Eventually, we got 52 people, all whose names are credited at the end of the film. The fellow that sent in the $500, his name is Gino Minari. He's in his 70s. And and about 2 months later, he sent me 67 boxes of Jim Garrison's material that went to the House Select Committee. It's in Dropbox. So I saw David Ferry's confession, and I called to thank the man. I met him. I was going to treat him to lunch for half an hour at an Italian restaurant. We were there for 3.5 hours. It was like we were Siamese twins about 5,000 years ago and separated. He went to Italy and I went to Scotland. He became one of the major contributors and editors and writers and researchers on the film. And without Gino, it would have never happened. You start a GoFundMe account for your film, and I will see to it that myself and Gino and anybody that I can contact on my Facebook, and I have 1,000 friends, I am going to tell them to help fund your film, because your book is wonderful. And if your film shows just half of what's in the book, it is going to be so watchable and so interesting. So please, John, start a GoFundMe account.
Thanks so much, John. I guess I will now. I'll have to get my wife to help me because I'm kind of bad with technology. But thanks a lot for telling me.
I'll tell you what I will do. Another major contributor to my film, his name is David Lispy. He designed all the posters. He lives in Thailand. He's a computer genius. He can do anything. You know, the LA Times gave my film a non-review. They just dismissed it as... Yeah, conspiracy porn is what they... But they hammered me and said that I was just a curmudgeon with a grudge. And I am. I do have a grudge against bad writers like that. And against, and against injustice in America. Anyway, I will contact David. I will have him contact you. So when we're done, you're going to message me, because we're friends on Facebook. Message me your email site. I will have him contact you. He will help you build the GoFundMe site. He built my site, John Barber's World, for nothing, because he felt my work and the film had to be out there. And that's worth like $20,000. And then Gino will also help you, because he's a whiz at this. So you must do that.
Well, thanks so much, Sean.
Okay, now the next thing is, I know your wife wants to take you to some kind of reunion, but if you can, you get to New York between the 9th and the 11th is when I'll be there, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to see the film. Hopefully your reunion is after that. You will be my guest at the theater, and you will dine with us, okay?
Oh, God. I would love to do that. My wife might kill me, but I'm going to see if I can make that happen. I
got
to figure out how I can do that, but we'll see how – there's going to be a way. There's going to be some way where I'm going to –
As long as she's not Glenn Close, then you get to see that. Anyway, John, tell folks now where they can see the stuff that you write and buy the books that you write.
Thanks. So, well, you can get the books at it's drugsasweapons.com. And it's also called johnpodash.com or FBIWarOnTupac.com. But I guess the easiest to remember is drugsasweapons.com. That's my website that has both books and the film, the DVD, based on the first book. And so it's funny, though. When I was – I'm actually – I've done a lot of my film already. It's close to finish, but there's just so much more to do. You know how there's always so much more to do.
And it's always last minute, too.
Yeah, right. And so it's funny that when you mentioned James DiEugenio, because he's in my film also as an expert on Jimi Hendrix. And so it was, you know, it was good. It was good to overlap, you know, people like that who are doing good work out there on all these different issues.
You're absolutely right. Anyway, my very best to your wife. Tell her you will somehow get to the reunion, but you also have to go see John's film, because I'm telling you something, John, you're going to be absolutely blown away by it, especially seeing it on a large screen. It is so not only powerful intellectually, but emotionally. It's a terrific film. Anyway, yeah, thank you again.
I'd love to see it, so I'm going to see what I can do without, you know, breaking up my marriage. I'm going to see if I can make it work. All right.
Well, thank you so much, John. The best of luck to you. We'll
Thanks
be right
so much
back.
To you, John.
With Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing at last?
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs. Conspiracy theories and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World, every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you so much. This is John Barber. That was John Potash. I can't wait to see his documentary. I certainly will go to see the major film, because if it's half as good as JFK, it's going to be worth seeing. But right now, I want to talk to my cohort, somebody without whom I could not do this show, and somebody without whom I wouldn't know what was going on with the world, with his absolutely outstanding news vandal, the creator of that great news daily newsletter.
Wait, John, you know what's going on in the world? Could you tell me?
No, Joe, how are you? You know, I got a million questions for you. And you know what I have to start talking about is what everybody is talking about. I went to pick up some DVDs today of my film. And John had at it, you edit. The first thing he said to me, he says, you know what I have to do now? He said, aside from looking at the rest of your film, he said, I have to go read those Paris Accords because I don't know what anybody is talking about. He said, can you tell me something about it? I said, no, but you listen Monday night the 12th and Joe Satilli will explain it to you. So you tell me a little bit about, did Trump do right? Did Trump do wrong? And what are the Paris Accords when it comes to the environment in global warming?
Trump did not do anything that is in any way, shape, or form going to have any real impact on the question at hand. The Paris Accords, Paris Agreement, Climate Agreement, sometimes it's called, is a non-binding treaty, and it was designed as such because the people who were negotiating it, including the United States, which took the lead, knew that they would never get that treaty through the Senate. So what they did to make it adoptable by the vast majority of countries, right now the only three countries that have not signed on are the United States, Syria, and Nicaragua. And I, you know, come on, Nicaragua is a comedy word. Whenever you could say Nicaragua, you know it's going to be funny. But the funny thing about Nicaragua is that apparently Daniel Ortega, remember him of the Central American wars? He says it doesn't go far enough. So basically, really, it's Donald Trump and Bashar al-Assad. And here's what's going on.
Well, why wouldn't this have gotten through the Senate, do you think?
Because there are particularly at that time, there were guys like James Imhoff who believed that climate change is not only not real, but that the dominion of the Lord God over the planet makes it not only foolhardy to believe in climate change, but it's actually an affront to God's power over the planet to believe that human beings could change the climate. So James Imhoff and some of the other more right-wing, evangelical-oriented folks in the Senate were going to be able to block it no matter what. So it was never going to get through the Senate. And ultimately, really, the way I look at the climate deal is it's like an AA meeting. Basically, the world came together and said, we need to admit we have a problem, because that's the first thing you have to do before you get there. And what they did is they set up a number of goals and monitoring standards. And really, it's about creating a data set upon which future meetings can develop more stringent goals and targets. The overall target is to try and keep warming under 2 degrees Celsius over the course of the next 50 years, because any wiggle room in that, basically the idea is the models say it's going to be catastrophic. Now, the models are squishy, and models are always going to be squishy. What we do know is what's happening now. The Maldives are going underwater. The right now, Louisiana and the Mississippi Delta is having a big problem with water coming in. You're starting to see communities being impacted by it. Ocean sea level rise. The oceans are rising. It is actually happening. And we have major acidification. And what acidification is doing is, because you have these changes in ocean temperatures, you have massive fish migrations from one part of an ocean to another part of an ocean.
In other words, what you're saying is climate change and the warming weather is a reality.
I was actually, by around 2002 to 2003, I was still what would be called a skeptic. I was looking at all the different data sets. There was a lot of talk about things like solar radiation flares and cosmic radiation, all these other things. And I know something about geology. My second wife was a geologist. I know about geologic time. There's a way of looking at the planet's temperature saying that we are still coming out of the last ice age. That was one of the interpretations. But when you start to look at the data sets that have accumulated over the last decade, since I was a skeptic, there's no debate. It's over.
Last time I talked to you, I mentioned that 5 weeks ago I was playing St. Andrews in Scotland, and just offhandedly, a couple of the golfers, the Scotsmen, were telling me that, of course, St. Andrews is right next to the Black Sea, and they're worried that waters are rising and may destroy four holes on beloved St. Andrews.
Yeah, this is happening. So the question is, what do you do about it, right? And I think what you see with Trump's action, because here's the bottom line. You know that carbon emissions are actually declining. They're going down. And a lot of this is being achieved because the market is enforcing the change in the production of CO2 and other climate-changing emissions.
Well, let me ask you this then, Joe. If this is a non-binding agreement, so it means like it does – it just – it's like a rubber band. You can stretch it. You know, it's not a piece of string or a chain that's tied to it. So why wouldn't Trump, just to please the Europeans, go along with it, knowing he didn't have to pay any attention to it?
Well, this is the question, right? I mean, here's the thing. I was thinking about this. Wouldn't it have been an amazing political win for him to get people off of his back on some level, or at least imagine – how shocked everybody would have been if he said, no, we're going to stay in, but what I want to do is, because I'm a great deal maker and I'm a great negotiator, I want to return to the table. We want to have a new conference. I'm going to convene it here in New York City. We're going to have a second conference. I want to lead it, and I want to come up with a fair structure that works for everybody, but I'm not going to pull out now. The whole world would have said, oh my gosh, look at Donald Trump. It's amazing. But he didn't do that. And
Did you say this other guy's name was Imhoff, this guy that had...
Yeah, James Imhoff, yeah.
Okay, let me ask. James Imhoff, or whoever he is, Senator Imhoff, you mean people actually voted for him?
They voted for him, yes.
Okay, he is living proof that there is no God. Because God, who created the universe, isn't stupid enough to create a man that stupid. Yeah, well. And then the voters who voted for a man that stupid.
Yeah, Imhoff is the guy who famously, during a snowstorm in D.C., he's from Oklahoma, and Oklahoma, by the way, is one of the leading oil states over the last 100 years. There's no there's a reason for it, right? For his intransigence beyond his religious devotion, he came out with he brought a snowball from outside the Capitol and brought it into the floor of the Senate and said, "See this snowball? This proves that there's no global warming."
Oh my God!
So now this is a famous thing, right?
God. It's like the monkey trial. It's like the Scopes monkey trial. These people still populate the planet. Well, they still populate the Senate. It's reprehensible. I want to go from.
Well, let me make one point.
Go ahead.
I think
go
that's
ahead.
A great look. It's very easy. I can understand why people would have skepticism. I have no problem with skepticism. That's what science is built on, skepticism, constant peer review and constant analysis. But I think the funny thing about this is that over the last decade, we've seen a spike in jobs in renewable energy. Right now, the number that's out there right now is 500,000 jobs going towards renewable energy related professions. I've actually seen it go up to 800,000. And the fastest growing blue collar job in America is solar panel installer. Meanwhile, China just brought online the world's largest solar power facility. So the question is like, we are it's happening. It's actually here. And if you're interested in the market and you're interested in creating jobs and you're interested in innovation, you're interested in putting people to work, why wouldn't anybody embrace the switchover? Because, John, as you know, there's nothing more profitable than going from beta to VHS, from VHS to DVD, from DVD. You know what I mean? That's how corporations make money. And so if we're in one of those transitions, why not embrace it?
From buggies to automobiles.
Exactly.
You know, man's technology improves dramatically every single year. But man's wisdom hasn't grown one foot in a million years. Now, from one failed president to a failed presidential candidate, why on earth is Bernie Sanders getting so much airtime?
I think a lot of it has to do – it's a directly proportionate equation. The more that Hillary Clinton flaps her gums about what she thinks went wrong, I think the more people feel wistful for what might have been had Bernie Sanders gotten that nomination.
Yes, but emotionally, everybody knew what Hillary was like. Everybody knew it, but they were still going to vote for her because they figured it was better than Donald Trump. But for those who voted and supported Bernie – were interested in Bernie, and I was one of the first, even though I said a year ago that this guy is going to turn into the Democrats' Ron Paul and he's going to break my heart. He was probably stunned that he got 12 million voters. He was the only one who had people working for him under 30, for crying
right.
out loud.
You're right.
But you look at that man and you're looking at a coward. You're looking at a political and moral coward. He should have stepped back and started. He should have joined the Green Party or started an independent third party. He could have thrown the election into the House of Representatives. Then there would be real debate after 50 years about war and peace in America. And it's all gone. So I do not understand why anybody would even put him on the air.
No, I understand why they put him on the air, because he's actually right now the de facto leader of the Democratic Party. But and maybe this is why he didn't do what you suggested. I actually, I tend to agree with you. I think that there was a unique opportunity in the last election cycle for somebody to break off and start a third party. Here's the question about the third party thing, is that if you're going to do it, you have to be willing to lose in the short run to build something that will win in the long run.
Exactly.
And I think this is the problem that America always faces with a third party, is they want a third party to pop up and to win and be instantaneous, when it's actually something that's going to have to be built over the course of two or three election cycles. I, the guy who had that opportunity was Ross Perot. And unfortunately, there were some hijinks, and they, you know, there was that whole thing about him, his daughter's wedding being harassed and all that. And I think that that was gamed because there was a longstanding grudge between Ross Perot and George Herbert Walker Bush. The hatred between the two of them, which goes back to POWs, and the fact that Ross Perot was made POWs are by Ronald Reagan, because Ross Perot in the 70s used to hire his own mercenary armies to go into South
America. Yes, Central. I remember.
So when there's this famous interview that he gave to Monica Jensen Stevenson, I don't want to say her name is, I'm sorry, but it's a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. She was a producer for CBS 60 Minutes, and she interviewed Ross Perot, and Ross Perot said, I talked to George Bush and I said, George, I keep going to Southeast Asia looking for our boys, and all I do is I find our boys dealing drugs.
Oh, and my God.
That interview was killed. And that led to a longstanding grudge between Herbert Walker Bush and Perot. And some people believe that Perot actually only got into that race to torpedo Herbert Walker Bush as revenge. Now, to get back to Bernie Sanders, you know, it's interesting. I think he has the same limitation that Trump has. Bernie Sanders wants to bring back a manufacturing economy that is over. He need a time machine to bring that back. But he has, you know, the appeal is there, and I get the appeal. But, he, you know, he's still an independent who caucuses with the Democrats and all this. I think really the fact that Bernie Sanders gets all that airtime shows the extent to which the Democratic Party is a leaderless party and a party without any significant identity.
Well, let's go to now a very successful leader and talk about interviews. Putin with Megyn Kelly. Did you see?
Yeah. Well, Putin had quite a week. Look, Putin is basically trolling the United States. He's trolling the world, but he's trolling the United States. Oh, you know, we didn't do the hacking, but there could have been a patriotic Russian who woke up one morning and saw that people were speaking ill of Russia, and maybe he would have wanted to do something about it, but we had nothing to do with it. Now, I'm not saying he admitted anything. I think he's actually just effing with us. He's just having a laugh. And, John, I think this is the ultimate thing to bring it back around to the Paris thing. I think the interesting thing about Donald Trump is that he is so self-absorbed, and his form of American exceptionalism is really just a reflection of his own view of his own exceptionalism, that this narcissism is actually – his version of American exceptionalism is actually destroying American exceptionalism. And it could be that in the long run, Donald Trump will have – I don't want to say a net positive effect, but the fact that he is creating space for the rest of the world to have freedom to maneuver in a world in which the United States made all the rules and set all the tempos and called all the tunes may, in a funny kind of way, be a net positive for the world over the course of the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, I may have mentioned this to you before, but in 1970, because you have a really interesting article here about manufacturing never coming back here, Buckminster Fuller not only said 40 or 50 years from now, those who will be the luckiest in the country will be those with jobs. He says, but you know what the most underdeveloped country in the world is? And I said, no, sir, what? He said, we are. And I laughed and I said, how can you say that? He said, John, we have the technology and the brains and the smarts and the manufacturing ability to feed and house not only every American, but every human being on the planet. So instead of going over there with guns, if we went over there with factories and teachers and doctors, we could literally save the world. But not using this talents, we have become the most underdeveloped country in the world. And you know, I have to agree with them. Yeah. And I don't see how we can ever get manufacturing back, even though Trump talks about repealing NAFTA, because we are a service economy. And how can a service economy grow? What more can you serve?
Well, the other thing is that the manufacturing that went to other places is now being turned over to robots. And right now, China is the world's leading producer of industrial robots. In China, like Buckminster Fuller would have liked the United States to do, they have this thing called One Belt, One Road, where they are building – they have put $1 trillion-plus of their money into infrastructure projects in other countries. So they are building infrastructure in other countries, and the United States is now haggling with itself over where it's going to build, rebuild its own infrastructure. And you know how they're going to do it? This is the plan, is that Kushner went over to Saudi Arabia, organized that what's going to could be a $350 billion deal on the predicate that they are going to put money into Blackstone. Blackstone is a huge equity fund, hedge fund here in the United States. Then that hedge fund, which is putting money into Kushner's – bailing out Kushner's debts, is then going to use that money that they're getting from Saudi Arabia in addition to their money, because they want to build toll roads in America. And at the same week that that happened was the week that Donald Trump came out and said, you know, I think we need to start opening up restrictions on toll roads, because the only way that you're going to get infrastructure in the United States is if people on Wall Street can charge you for running your car on their roads, which shows you the difference in the long-term strategy. And the American strategy is wring every last cent out of this dying system while we can, whereas China has this 5, 10, and 20-year plan where they're building infrastructure around the world, they're building robots, and they're going ahead with the cutting edge of biotech research.
Well, if you look at America's roads and highways, they should belong to the taxpayers, because when you think about the history of automobiles, there were no roads, paved roads, to drive Fords and Chevrolets on when they came out of the factory. So what happens is that they start selling gasoline and they set aside a little highway tax. They take that highway tax and they build these highways so Ford can sell more Fords and GM can sell more Chevys or whatever. But the truth is, our taxes were used to benefit the car manufacturers, but we got great pleasure out of driving the cars and traveling around America. Those roads should belong to Americans. They shouldn't be sold to anyone, and they shouldn't be. And our government, whether on a state level or on a federal level, has no business charging people to ride on roads that they already paid for.
Well, but John, that's the common good. And
it doesn't exist anymore.
It's we don't believe in the common good, and we actually it's kind of like a Serengeti thing out there. It's every man for themselves, every woman for themselves, and it's look, America has been divided, America is being conquered, and the people who are dividing and conquering it, this two-party paradigm that we're in, are basically getting away. That's where all that wealth and income inequality didn't just come out of nowhere. There were things done, and by dividing the American working and middle class amongst itself and creating these culture wars, which look, Trump is doing it. He's going to have a rally tomorrow. Pittsburgh, not Paris. Yeah, that's right. Pittsburgh, not Paris, because you know Paris, they're a bunch of sex-having Frenchies over there, and we're going to dip our freedom fries in ketchup from Heinz ketchup, which comes from Pittsburgh, right? So you have these kinds of culture wars, and people are fighting amongst themselves over these social things, that these social rifts that are actually created and manufactured. And John Potash talked about some of, you know, his whole career has been made exposing how these rifts are created artificially in the culture. Meanwhile, the people at the top, the financial elites, of which Donald Trump and Kushner and all the people in Donald Trump's administration are epitomize that kind of financial elite, are making money hand over fist.
But you have a really interesting column in your News Vandal today about the UK and the United States have the slowest growing economies. I feel that, because I say it's just a service economy. We don't make anything. And yet somehow, why on earth is the stock market surviving and growing? Why isn't it just crumbling?
Because price-to-earning ratios are 17 to 1. They're actually approaching 18 to 1, which means that for every dollar earned by a company, the price of that company is 17 times the actual earnings it produces. So when you have that kind of outsized, that distortion in the market, it's really just people gaming it. It's a casino, right? They're basically just running it up. And ultimately, this is because the anything that they do on Wall Street, they know it is backed with the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury. So if they bungle it like they've done repeatedly in this boom and bust cycle since the end of Carter and the beginning of the Reagan administration, multiple boom and busts, they know that the American taxpayer is going to bail them out and they're going to get off scot-free. And so they can basically do stock buybacks and run up the price of their own stock by artificially inflating it, by buying their own stocks with money that was given to them by the U.S. Treasury, and nobody blinks an eye. And because everybody else is so busy struggling just to make ends meet, and you have people working two jobs and a stagnant economy where unemployment is down, but did you know that unemployment is down, but a bunch of jobs were lost? How does that happen? Because people are leaving the workforce through attrition partially, but also because the people have given up working. They've given up looking for work or they're in jobs that are not counted as employed, right? So this is a distorted economic system. It is a financialized system in which debt has become a commodity. And when you have a debt-driven environment of high financialization and you're not just making money off of widgets, it's not about selling refrigerators, it's actually about selling exotic financial instruments where we take all kinds of weird specious debt that's often, you know, risky and package it together and turn that into a product that we sell to somebody else on Wall Street, and we're just moving money across computer screens. You're going to end up with the kind of flaccid environment in which the people who can move the money make the money, and the people who have to build things to put money in their pockets, there's nothing for them to build.
Well, you build a great, great, great news, Vandal. I just love it, and I forward it to my friends. Some of them cannot afford Patreon to the $25.
Well, that's why it's free. That's why it's free. But hey, you know, John, tell people what's coming up next week.
What's coming up next week?
Yeah, what's happening at on Friday?
Oh, thanks. I thought maybe you were going to appear on Max Kaiser again.
No. We got to get people, because if anybody is in the tri-state area, they've got to get where? Where do they have to go?
They have to get to Cinema Village in Greenwich Village. It opens June the 9th. There are four screenings a day, so that means it'll run from the 9th to the 16th, but I will only be there from the 9th till the 12th, and I'll be doing a Q&A after the 4 p.m. screening, and that's on Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday I will be doing a Q&A after the 6:30 screening. And I must tell you, these Q&As are so interesting. We had such fantastic people coming to, even if sometimes we were only a third full in the house afterwards, nobody left. They loved the film and they all wanted to talk. Now, a lot of them had questions, but most of them, Joe, had information. And one lady was a lady who ran for Congress, and she just lost by a few votes. And she gave the audience so much information about the deep state. It was thrilling. I wished I could have filmed her. I would have put her up on YouTube. She was just wonderful. Well, there are all kinds of people like this. It's just astonishing. Absolutely. And while Jim D. Eugenio loved the film, and he said, "Where did you find this? I didn't know that." And Wayne Madsen said the same thing. The most moving comment came from William Madsen Law, who probably knows more about the autopsy than David Lifton in Best Evidence. He is probably the most respected, one of the most respected and revered researchers at all. He was almost in tears at the end of the film, and he could barely talk. He said, "This moved me so much emotionally." And I know my wife has seen it 10 times. She cannot watch television for 2 days after she watches it. And I say, why? Because she loves Judge Judy, okay? I say, Judge Judy is on. And she says, honey, I just watched your film. I have to get over it. I can't watch this frivolity and meaningless stuff for another few days. So she has to take this culture break. But anyway, I'm really curious. I'm disheartened that alternative, I know that the mainstream media is not going to, if they review it like they did the LA Times, they just dismiss it as conspiracy porn and they attack me, I don't mind. But at least if I'm going to be attacked by somebody who can write and somebody knows the case, somebody who can disprove some of my facts. But I'm disheartened because the Village Voice won't review it. I'm disheartened by the LA Weekly. You know, at LA Weekly in the 70s offered $1 million reward for information leading to the arrest of somebody involved in the murder of John Kennedy. And that's when the owner was shot in the back and crippled for life. So there you go. But none of them wanted to review it, which is startling to me. And I do know, thank goodness for Christine Blasely, the GM of KPFK in Los Angeles, she so loved it. She used it as the foundation of their two-week pledge drive. Sold out on Thursday night. Okay, that's it's 250 people sending in $100 for two tickets and a DVD. So 125 people. So, and they did that. They did that in 2 days, two airings of the hour interview that we did. But thank goodness for her. But the fellow that I had on, and I think you were on with him, who does Project Censored, I forget his name. Really.
Mickey Huff.
Mickey Huff broadcasts from KQED, I believe, in San Francisco. And
it's KPFA.
KPFA.
Which is a sister station of KPFK.
That's right. But he said on the air, it's getting bad even at Pacifica because it's being infiltrated also. And there's so much infighting as what you can cover and not cover on Pacifica Radio. Now, that's the last bastion in the United States is Pacifica Radio. But you had your experience at PBS when you did that wonderful documentary about depleted uranium.
Well, I was at the ABC affiliate, WJLA. So I wasn't.
I thought you were at PBS.
No, I was at PBS, but not for depleted uranium. But John, look, the environment now is such that I think one of the things is the thing that you have to break through. Look, the ultimate thing is if people hear you talk, they buy in, and that's sort of the connective tissue, because I think that there is such fatigue in the system now. People have so much fatigue that you have to break through it, and that's tough. But I think this is, to me, the art movie is a long game. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. It's going to build. And you had a very successful run there in Los Angeles, and I expect a very successful run there in New York. And then when you move into a full-on you have multiple – film festival.
Yes, I only am concerned about two. Of course, Toronto. I would love it to get in Toronto because then it's local boy makes good, and Moscow because
that would be perfect.
I want Trump to do for me, or Putin to do for me what he did for Trump, but I am nervous because I've already been to. I was turned down by the Las Vegas Film Festival. They didn't even send me a letter. I discovered by accident when I went to their site, and my documentary was instead of the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, they picked another documentary called Pussy.
Yeah.
I'm not lying. It's called Pussy. So I wrote them a note and I said, well, no wonder, I mean, with selections like that, it is no wonder that no one outside of the building that houses this film festival knows that this festival even exists, because as the commercial says, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. I'm stunned. So it is in your face, tough truth-telling, told in a very interesting, sometimes very funny way. It's a story that I tell, okay? I tell multiple stories in the film, and I'm enormously proud of it. As I said, people, not one person moves when they sit for 2 hours. People don't fidget or whatever. I mean, once in a while they may rush to the restroom, but they rush. They rush out and they rush back. So anyway, I look forward to going to New York, Joe, and I'm really, really glad that you were a part of it. I'm glad that you got to see the film. I'm sorry you didn't get to see it in a theater. We're on a large screen. It is enormously powerful. Anyway, tell folks where they can hear you again, where they can go to get your news.
Well, you hear me in 2 weeks here, and then just go to info at, or actually you can email me at info@newsvandal.com or just go to newsvandal.com. But folks, definitely get on the Facebook page, the Second Assassination Facebook page. You can get through it through John Barber's Facebook page. You get all the latest information. Because here's the thing, John. I know this from people asking me through personal messaging. People want to know when they can get a chance to see it. And that's actually – you have a lot of pent-up demand because you're doing the thing to go through the Academy Award process with the two showings. But once you get past that and you can actually start delivering it to people who want to see it, I think you're going to see a huge upswell of support.
What I'm going to try to do, I'm going to try to meet with an expediter. Netflix and those outfits deal with what they call expediters. They don't deal directly with independent film producers unless you're 20th Century Fox or Universal. And what this expediter does is he negotiates and he gets it on Netflix and Hulu and iTunes and places like that, and I'll sell it for only $4 or $5, which is really reasonable, and it's what they sell their movies for. And I have a feeling it could go viral even at $4 or $5, and the first monies that I make, if I make any money, will go to building a law scholarship in Jim Garrison's name at Tulane University.
So which would be apt, yeah.
Anyway, again, Joe, thank you so much. I couldn't do the show without you. Thanks to Doug and Don Knudsen, who own this wonderful BBS radio and support all of us here. And again, I could never produce this show by myself. It is produced by Mike Kim, who does an absolutely wonderful job. And as Admiral used to say, folks, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.